Dacus language and culture course, and we taught it for many years. And since then, I've also been in the communities and at the university and in the schools and the college, sharing my knowledge of the Dacus language and culture. So it brings me, I'm still doing it today, and now I'm getting my degree.
Your journey of initially coming to UMBC to get an education and then transitioning to delivering an education for other people has been quite a journey over the past several years. As you move into the future, do you have hopes for what else can be achieved on this campus for future students? What do you see the future of language instruction here at UMBC being?
I know with the language and culture, we in the community, the fluent speakers, are working towards the revitalization of the language and culture. It's become an endangered language now. So when I was working here, I was instrumental in having the teacher's diploma program offered in the community. And we did get it offered in Nacusley, and students did their diploma degree. Then a few of them continued on and moved to Prince George campus to get their Bachelor of Education degree. I'd like to see more of that happening. It also was, after it was offered in Nacusley, other communities used that as a template, and a couple other communities have had people go through the program and do their Bachelor of Education degree. I'd like to see more of that happening. My language and culture is important to me and my family, all my siblings, my sisters, and my mom are language and culture teachers too now. My one sister was one of the ones that went through the diploma program, got her B.Ed., and is now acting principal at her community elementary school in Nacusley. And those are my success stories, and I'd like to see more of that happening. I want to remember that along with me is my mom and dad, who taught me my language and culture at a very young age and taught me who I am. And want to remember my late dad and my mom and my siblings, my adult children, my husband, and my mentors with the language and culture after I started sharing my knowledge, who are my late Aunt Catherine Caldwell and Nellie Prince, of course. I've done a lot of work with her. I co-taught the course with her here, and her and I have done a lot of publications and curriculum development together. So I don't want to forget those mentors in my life too.
You'll be acknowledging the 2025 graduating class at this year's convocation at UMBC, and along with that, you're receiving an honorary degree in law. Does that carry a particular weight for you? What do you think the future holds for you now with that under your belt?
In my first class I took here was Dacus language and culture, and it was that first group of students in that first class before the campus opened. We were taking courses downtown in the Quick Start program, and it was our group that suggested the motto for UNBC, and Cha Hana, which means respect all forms of life, be respectful. And that's one of my main teachings, is to be respectful of others and your surroundings, the plants, the lakes, the trees, the forests, the rivers, the water, the birds, to be respectful of everything with life, and then you'll earn respect. You don't just get it, you have to earn it. And that's what I want, is to try to live that life the best I could and to pass that knowledge on so that everyone's respectful of everything with life.
If I can explore that a little further, is that, do you feel that's your interpretation of what law is fundamentally, or how you'd like to see it applied?
Yeah.
I appreciate it. Thanks for speaking with us today, Yvonne.
This is Ian Gregg reporting for CIFA Radio's Due North on 88.7 FM. This initiative is made possible by the Community Radio Fund of Canada through the Local Journalism Initiatives Program. Find our news stories online at frequencynews.ca or cfur.ca.
My voice pouring through your radio device to you. I'm Ahilan, volunteer at CJSF, and I'm here to recognize you as the most important aspect of the radio we make. That's right, radio is all about you. You, the listener. Thanks to you, CJSF 90.1 FM provides diverse programming to best fit your ears. Happy listening!
That's right. Thank you for listening to Speak Up here on CJSF 90.1 FM. Burnaby, I don't just want to be shouting out into the void. I want to know and do know, and am reassured by the fact that you're out there listening at the very least, and hopefully being impacted by what I say and do and play, reacting, generating emotions, whatever that might be. I really do appreciate you hanging out and taking a little bit of time out of your day, or just allowing me to tag along with whatever you might be doing anyway. You just heard Chancletazo by Empanadas Ilegales, a psychedelic cumbia and salsa band from here in Vancouver. Their new record, Sancocho Trifásico, comes out June 6th, just under a month from now. So you can look forward to that. I'm sure it will take over the charts here at CJSF. Maybe not as much as Devours did, but we'll see. Anyway, I want to keep things rolling so that we can hear all of our last talk piece for the day, which is community reporter Danny Nesvedarani's interview with SFU's Andréane Doyon. And so we're just going to get right into that. And once again, thank you.
Reporting from Burnaby, BC, this is Danny Nesvedarani, your community journalist for CJSF 90.1 FM. A recent research study out of Simon Fraser University in Burnaby has highlighted the gaps in the province's response to extreme heat events. Spearheaded by Andréane Doyon, associate professor at SFU's School of Resource and Environmental Management, this is the first time that BC's extreme heat response among local governments has been analyzed in a formal research study. To gain more insight on what gaps, as well as potential solutions in BC's heat mitigation strategies that Doyon identified through this study, CJSF reached out to speak with her on the topic. During our interview, we spoke about what motivated Doyon to pursue this project, how different jurisdictions in BC can collaborate on heat mitigation, and the next steps of this research, which includes a look at the housing policy of one of the areas most affected by the extreme heat dome in the summer of 2021, Burnaby, BC.
I spent 6.5 years in Australia, and that's where I did my PhD, and then did my first academic position. And that's useful because in Australia, it gets pretty hot. So in the summer of 2021, when we were experiencing the heat dome event, I began getting a lot of requests from media asking me, can I talk about the relationship between cities and climate change? And I was like, of course I can. And, you know, obviously part of that was, well, how does heat play into it? And so, again, having this interest in cities and climate change and then having lived somewhere where planning for heat is much more common, I was having these really great conversations and being called in, and I kept asking myself, like, you know, what else should I be doing? But also, like, what research is missing? What does it look like to ask questions within a region that has historically not experienced a lot of extreme heat events? So thinking about our you know, relatively temperate climate here, you know, in Vancouver, but in the Pacific Northwest as well. So I was really interested in, you know, after surviving the summer of 2021, I was like, I want to study heat here. I really want to know what's happening, and then how can we improve our preparedness and our response for future extreme heat events. So that's kind of the background where my interests and my experiences collided, and then I really wanted to see if there was something here. So I applied for a grant with the Social Science and Humanities Research Council of Canada, SHRC, and was successful in getting that money. So myself and my team of grad students began to start investigating questions around planning for extreme heat within the region.
And if you could just talk about what were some of those conclusions that you did come to, like from the research in terms of solutions regarding how BC and different jurisdictions can address extreme heat events.
Yeah, so we were really interested in understanding the role of planning. So really thinking about within that, the role or mechanisms of urban greenery, urban design, and then land use planning. So what we were seeing is that a lot of the response was public health and emergency management, which is really important, but those tend to be quite short-term in their thinking. There's a heat wave, you know, predicted next week. What are we doing about it? Whereas I'm really interested in in 10 years from now, will our neighborhoods and our houses and our cities be better prepared? So we wanted to look at that question. So what were they doing? And so when you think about what can cities or municipalities do, cities tend to be a lot hotter than naturalized environments or rural environments due to the urban heat island effect. And that is because our cities are made up of much harder surfaces. So harder surfaces and darker colors really absorb heat. We see less vegetation, which also sort of helps create more heat. And we see a lot less, you know, wind and other types of things that can move things through. So we see these really hot pockets exist in cities, but also within cities, depending on the type of development that is occurring in that density. So one mechanism, and the mechanism that is most popularly used, not only in the lower mainland here, like in Metro Vancouver, Fraser Valley, but kind of globally, is urban greenery. So it's increasing vegetation, tree cover, canopy, access to parks, and also access to what people call blue spaces. So like rivers, lakes, ponds, oceans, you know, if you live on the coast, it's cooler as well. So that's the most common response. And, you know, perhaps not surprising, it's an easy sell. Most people like trees, most people like parks. So wanting to either maintain or increase tree cover, canopy, and parks is usually something that politically is easier to sell. A lot of residents want that. Also, grand side of things, it's not the most expensive of interventions. Of course, creating a brand new park can be quite costly, but planting some trees compared to some other initiatives, you know, can be lower cost as well. So that's what we see, and we did see that here. Other interventions really focus on the more sort of standard, what we'd consider to be the built environment. So one of that is about looking at the relationship between how much hard surfaces do we have and how much vegetation do we have? What types of materials are we using? We know that darker colors creates even more hotter environments. So you see places like Australia that really are pushing for people to have light colored roofs to, you know, have the exterior of their homes with lighter colors because it, you know, it does help. The quality of construction of our homes makes a huge difference. So well-insulated homes help to keep your home cooler in the summer and warmer in the winter. So we know that during the heat dome, 98% of the people who lost their lives did so within residential units. So they did so within homes. So we know moving forward, much more attention needs to be provided there. Air conditioning is obviously sort of a solution that particularly the provincial government, BC Hydro, and the health authorities really responded with. And that's important, particularly within vulnerable populations, seniors, and people with existing health conditions. But it's not really a great solution long term.
The one part of the research study that I noticed what talked about how different jurisdictions can sort of better collaborate when it comes to addressing extreme heat within the province. What are some of the mechanisms or strategies around that?
Well, one of the things we found is that there were, in fact, some municipalities were doing really great work, right? So we see, you know, Vancouver, Surrey, New Westminster is having a lot of really great programs and initiatives. And so part of our kind of, and this might feel like a kind of a throwaway thing, but part of wanting municipalities to collaborate is some of your neighbors might already be doing good work. You don't have to reinvent the wheel. You can just learn from someone who's already maybe a little bit further ahead. So really wanting, you know, municipalities to think about that. There's a lot of knowledge already in the region. Perhaps you can share and build off of that. So that's really important. The other thing is when we think about planning, at the municipal level, it's connected to the province because the province decides what is any municipality's responsibility, what powers they have, what they don't have. So there's a connection there, but there's also a connection in terms of the province will mandate or create programs to encourage municipalities to do things. And so if the province says heat is something that you need to respond to, municipalities will respond to, right? If the province isn't saying anything, then individual municipalities are really left to themselves to decide if it's something that they want to do anything about. So one of the things we looked at is every municipality in the province has complete these climate scorecards. And we were interested to see what were they putting on them. And so we did actually note that a number of them were starting to put heat as something that they were worried about. So again, but what we need is sort of top-down response from the province to kind of mainstream heat as a hazard that municipalities need to worry about, but also provide some information, some resources to help these municipalities out. Vancouver and Surrey are very well resourced. We were not surprised that they had more programs. They have huge teams, lots of capacity, and they're leaders in climate action in the province. What about the municipalities that don't have those teams, those capacity? How do they get started? So, you know, the province can play a really strong role there. And the province can also help create better relationships between the health authorities and the municipalities.
I know that your follow-up research seems to have a focus specifically within Burnaby. What have you seen so far that the municipality or city of Burnaby has done regarding heat mitigation, you know, knowing that during the 2020 heat dome, they were one of the municipalities that were most affected by the heat?
Yeah, so that's actually one of the reasons why we picked them. So they were the fourth highest death rate during the 2021 heat dome. And we, again, wanted to focus on housing because of the impact that housing had on people's survival rates. Also, City of Burnaby, and this is something that not everyone might know, it actually is really progressive in its housing policy. So throughout the region, Burnaby's doing really great things in terms of the housing policy space. So we wanted to look at this question of housing in a city that was both impacted by the extreme heat event, but also was already doing things in housing. And we wanted to see, is there a relationship between housing and heat, but also equity, because that's a big part of understanding the impacts of this. We chose Burnaby for those reasons. It's also great because we work in Burnaby, right? At SFU, that's where we're located. So it was also an opportunity to connect and work with local folks. Also, we thought Burnaby provided a bit of a context that we could learn from and think about across the province. So Burnaby, in terms of our first study of looking at, well, who is planning for heat and how, they kind of were mid-pack. They weren't doing nothing, but they weren't the best. So we also thought, as sort of a mid-pack municipality in terms of their heat response, we could hopefully find things that would be relevant for other municipalities to learn as well. So what we have found so far is something that I kind of discussed a bit earlier in terms of what the role the province could take is, in the city of Burnaby, no one owns heat. And this is something that kept coming up again and again in interviews. It's no one's responsibility. And yet a lot of staff members are doing things to respond to heat and to prepare for extreme heat events. But there's no one person, role, or department that explicitly has heat in their portfolio. It is something that social planners are working on, land use planners, emergency management, the libraries, community services. There's lots of people involved, but no one is responsible for bringing this all together or for championing heat. And that's a problem because when you need to make big decisions, when you need to bring things to council, when you want a champion, but you also want it to be, again, in someone's job description or department, because then it gets attention all year round.
The last thing that I would like to ask you is if you have any advice or recommendations for people who want to not only learn more about heat mitigation strategies, but how to advocate for them in their municipalities if they feel as if their local governments are coming short.
Yeah, I think, as you said, it is important to advocate at your local government level because they are the level of government that is the closest to you. And when it comes to, you know, again, urban greenery, urban design, land use, housing policy, a lot of that comes from your municipal governments. In different, municipalities that we looked at, in some of the municipalities that had really low, not a lot of programs or not a lot of explicit mentions of heat, we see that some of those cities are traditionally ones that have less climate action. So there is definitely a need to push that heat needs to be something that we think about. It needs to be something that we think about all year round. When this paper first came out a few weeks ago, I was worried because I was like, oh no, it came out in spring, not summer. Is anyone going to care? about planning for extreme heat. And people have been really receptive to it, which is really great. But that speaks to, we need to think about this all year round. We need to provide resources to it. For some, I think it's also about how you frame it. For some folks, we can think of extreme heat as a climate hazard, and we need to be thinking about our relationship to climate change in cities. For other municipalities or for other people, the way to approach this might be more on the health side, right? We want to prevent future deaths. We want to prevent future heat-related illnesses. During the heat dome, it's estimated that 5,000 to 6,000 people were impacted by heat-related illnesses in addition to the deaths, right? So it can be a heat issue. It's also a productivity issue, right? You know, I don't know if you remember, but it wasn't wonderful working conditions during these heat events as well. We think about the people working indoors, but also the people working outdoors. It was unworkable conditions. So we really need to be thinking about our ability. So I would really encourage folks to think about, what is the thing that you think your council is going to be more receptive to? Is it job productivity? Is it health? Is it climate change? And really work heat into those things, because heat actually does impact all of those things.
Once again, that was Andrianne Doyen, Associate Professor at SFU School of Resource and Environmental Management, on her research study that analyzed BC's extreme heat responses among local governments. Once again, this has been Danny Nesvedarani, your community journalist for CJSF 90.1 FM Burnaby. This segment would not have been possible without the continued support of the Community Radio Fund of Canada's Local Journalism Initiative. You can also find this piece on frequencynews.ca.
Welcome back to Speak Up on CJSF 90.1 FM Burnaby. I'm Jesse. Thanks for hanging out with me this hour and every Thursday and Tuesday from 10 to 11. I really appreciate the opportunity to share my thoughts and the things I like and the things I'm interested in with you. And I hope that you will continue to listen and support CJSF in the days and weeks and months to come. We're on 24/7 and we're all volunteer run. So, you know, we do what we do because we love doing it and we love doing what we do with you. So thank you, thank you, thank you. And Democracy Now! Will be up next. We're going to end off with a little bit of music. This one, it's all been local today. up next, we're going to hear the band Loup-Garou, sort of a take on the Loup-Garou, werewolf thing, from their new record, Graveyard Smash. This post-punk from Loup-Garou, this one is called If I Go Down to One, It's All Over. See you next time. And thank you.
I'm Kaylin. And I'm Rebecca.
We're the hosts of Sociologic, broadcasting live at CJSF 90.1 FM from 7 to 8 p.m. every Tuesday.
Tune in to hear meaningful conversations exploring all ideas through a sociological lens.